Alrighty, we're coming to the book of Obadiah this morning. A little tiny book, 21 verses. How many people have read it before? Anybody? About half of you. Well, more than half of you. It's not exactly the most popular book in the Bible, is it? Not exactly the most well-known book in the Bible. It's not a book that most people can find in the Bible. Tell people to find Obadiah and they'll pass over it 3 or 4 times because it's only 2 pages. You'll miss the whole thing. One page in your Bible? But anyway, it's a very important book. There's a lot of stuff in it. Okay, so turn in your exegetical outline notes to, it should be page 116, about page 114. You find it all there. You have the outline of the book of Obadiah, showing that it's broken down into 4 major points in your outline. And then the next page, which will be page 115, is the exegetical notes themselves. So are we all on page 115? It has the REL logo at the top. It says Introduction 1A. That'd be verse first part of verse 1, right? Everybody there? Page 115. All right, so let's work through this. What does verse 1, the first part of verse 1, say? Very straightforward, the vision of Obadiah. Obadiah. So we're going to use that phrase there as our introduction, go through the background of Obadiah. So you see point A in your outline, the meaning of his name, servant of the Lord, servant of Jehovah. That's about all. That's about all we know about this guy. Nothing else is known. We don't know of his father. Nothing is stated. Now, many times you'll run across genealogies in Scripture, but genealogies are not important in relation to the prophetic office. There's no need to have a genealogy here to know who his father was or any other progenitor. That's very different than the priestly office or the kingly office. From the priest had to be a descendant of the tribe of Levi, or they had to descend from Aaron, the Kohanim, the Levites and the priests. So you had to prove your descent to be a priest or Levite. And to be the king, you had to know your genealogy. You had to be from David's house, etc. And so you find genealogies for those two offices, but nothing for the office of prophet. Sometimes you see it, but it's not really needed. Okay, the date. Point B there. Well, we're not told what the date is. We have 3 clues. And your outline there shows the clue. First clue, number 1. Obadiah is quoted by Jeremiah. And so you see the three times, verses 1 through 4, 5 and 6 and 8 and 9. Just about half the book's quoted, isn't it? By Jeremiah. So that places Obadiah before Jeremiah chronologically. For Jeremiah to be able to quote him, that means he had to utter his revelation, write down his revelation first. So Jeremiah would have a copy of it and could read it. So we know that much. Second clue, verse 17 is quoted by Joel in Joel 2:32. So that places Obadiah before Joel chronologically, because Joel then read this little book that we'll be studying. Question.
Are we convinced that the quoting isn't the other way around? That Obadiah is quoting Jeremiah and Joel?
Well, we have one more clue here. We have something else here. We know Jeremiah because Jeremiah is in the way at the end, probably more at the end of the period. Joel and Obadiah, yeah, they're pretty much contemporaries. The key question, though, clue number three. In verses 10 through 14, there's a reference to the sacking of Jerusalem. What sacking of Jerusalem was it? And we have 2 options. One, point A there, 586 under Babylon. But there, Jerusalem was destroyed. And then, earlier than that, by about 300 years, 845 under Jehoram, there Jerusalem was pillaged but not totally destroyed. And that appears to be the best option. During that destruction, the Philistines and Arabs pillaged Jerusalem, and Edom helped. Edom did not directly participate Edom did not directly participate in that sacking, but cheered on Israel's enemies. So there was a sack of Jerusalem by the Philistines and Arabs. At that time, Edom had revolted from Jewish domination. Edom was battling against Israel, and that's found in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles there, your two cross-references under points A and B. So turning to page 116, the sacking of Jerusalem by the Philistines and the Arabs came about at the same time, 2 Chronicles 21, and that seems to best fit the evidence. So that would probably, and again, like Mac has pointed out, probably make Obadiah the first minor prophet chronologically around 845, 840 BC. We can't say for sure, but it appears that way. So this you've been given this chart. I don't know if I have any other copies of it up here, but if someone needs a copy of this chart, we can get you some more copies. Here's the kingdom period, the period of the vocal and writing prophets. Remember, 933, the kingdom split into Judah, the southern kingdom, and Israel, the northern kingdom. And the northern kingdom was a very ungodly kingdom. All the kings were bad. It got very heavily into idol worship. It was judged and then eventually destroyed by Assyria, the deportation coming in around 722. And it's during this time period that Obadiah, Joel, Hosea, Amos, and Jonah all prophesy. Obadiah probably being the first one. That appears to be probably the best position to take, but again, you can't be dogmatic about it. But it would look like Joel's the first prophet. Point C there, the locale is in Judah, because of D, the historical setting, which is the above-mentioned sacking of Jerusalem. So this takes place in Judah. He's a prophet from Judah to Judah. The major points, point E, that God will avenge Israel and God will restore Israel. A key theme is the doom of Edom. That's the theme of this little book. And finally, point G, the vision of Obadiah. That's a chazon. It's a divine communication that was visual. Divine communication that was somehow visual to Obadiah. So he was technically a seer. S-E-E-R. He saw something happen more than anything else. So he was a prophet. He was a seer. Well, a seer sees a vision. It's more of a visual communication of the revelation. Other prophets are God speaks to them. We'll see that when we get to Jonah. The word of the Lord came to Jonah saying, he didn't see anything, he was told. Okay. Remember, they're both prophets. Yeah, they're both receiving divine revelation directly from God, yes.
Isn't the word seer maligned nowadays? It's included
in
witchcraft.
I don't know. I don't know how the word seer is included today.
Bad
connotation of the word today. Well, in this case, it was not a bad connotation. It just meant one who... The bulk of the vision or the style of the vision was more visual than anything else. He saw something, God's TV set, or I don't know exactly what it was. Like I said, if it ever happens to me, I'll tell you. Now, three Jewish commentators, Radok, that's Rabbi David Kimke, Abarbanel and Malbim, Rabbi Abarbanel and Rabbi Malbim, along with Rabbi Kimke, all place the events of this book in the end times and at the beginning of the Messianic kingdom. So these three key commentators, key rabbis, do see this as speaking of Messianic times. So with that in mind, let me go ahead and pass out a chart on the time frames of Obadiah, and we'll see how I've broken it down. And there's actually a couple of options here, which you'll see on the chart. So let me, can I get some help? Hey, thank you, Saab. I'm tethered, so I got to watch it here. Let me hand out a bunch there and a bunch there. If you need one for a friend, that's fine as well. So this is a chart that's being handed out to you. Time frames of Obadiah. Thank you, Saab. Oops, we need one more. Hanna needs one. Can you run one back there to Hanna? Oh, okay. Did you get one? Okay, great. Okay, everybody have their time frames? Everybody have a copy? Good, okay. So Obadiah is going to take a little bit of jumping around in this very short little book. Not a lot, but a very similar pattern to what we've seen before. He starts off in his present time, 845, 840 B.C., who knows, in verses 1 through 14. And then he moves into the tribulation period in verses 15 and 16, and then into the Messianic kingdom in verses 17 through 21. And what's the pattern? The pattern is gloom and doom in the present, gloom and doom in the future, and glory at the end. Okay? God never leaves us squashed under judgment. Now, there is an option here, and we'll see when we get to the very end of the book, that it's possible that verses 10 through 16 may be referring to the tribulation period. So verses 1 through 9 might be the present, 10 through 16 the tribulation, 17 through 21 the future. So it's not a great variance there, but at this point I'm willing to say 15 and 16 are in the tribulation. And you'll see Dr. Fruchtenbaum in his notes also bring up the issue about verses 10 through 14. When do they fall? So that's the time frames we're looking at as far as Obadiah goes. Now, the second part of the verse, I'm going to call it 1b. It isn't on your notes as 1b. But it says, "Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom." Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. And I want us to look at Edom for a moment now and learn a little bit about the Edomites. Learn a little bit about them. Who are these guys that God is so upset with? And in order to do that, I'm going to hand out a couple of charts, and you can take notes on these charts. First of all, the first chart I'll hand out is called the Edomite Family Tree. So we'll learn a little bit about the origin of the Edomites first. So here's the Edomite Family Tree, right there. So we'll learn a little bit about them from that chart. And I'll hand out one other chart when I'm all done. That's a dictionary article that will summarize all this in one short page for you and give you a good idea who the Edomites were. Okay, everybody have a copy. Extra copies, where are they? Over there, great, that's fine, John, you can leave them there. I'll get them at the break. Everybody have one? Okay. Well, let's take a look at these guys called the Edomites. Well, the Edomites, as you see from the Edomite family tree here, the Edomites descended from Esau, the brother of Jacob. So we have here Abraham. Abraham fathered Isaac. He also fathered Ishmael and the descendants of Keturah. So he three elements that make up the modern Arab people, the Ishmaelites being the most prominent. Esau they have amalgamated into the Arab people. The Arab people are a combination of all three. Anyway, Abraham gave birth to Isaac. Isaac gave birth to two sons, Jacob and Esau, twin brothers. And these twin brothers battled against each other. They were at enmity against each other. Esau eventually fathered the Edomites, or as they became known later in New Testament history, the Idumeans. And we'll learn a little bit about them in just a few minutes. We'll take a look at the... let me show you the map right now. Eventually, the Edomites traveled down to the area of the Mount Seir mountain range and settled in the Mount Seir mountain range and founded the city of Edom. And throughout the history of the two nations... this is normally where you'll find Edom. So Edom and Israel, Edom and Judah, are constantly battling each other. It started with these two twin brothers at enmity with each other. Then their descendants, because the descendants of Jacob, of course, are the 12 tribes. And so we have their descendants battling against each other with great enmity. Yeah, that's what the arrows mean. They're struggling against each other, in conflict with each other. Eventually, an Arab tribe known as the Nabataeans, during the intertestamental period, basically moved into the area called Edom and displaced the Edomites. The Edomites then moved out of Edom and the Mount Seir mountain range into the territory that was occupied by Simeon, and then that area down here became known as Idumea. Idumea. That's just a Greek word, I believe, for Edomites. So we had, when that occurred, we have Judah to the north and Idumea to the south. Now, out of during the intertestamental period, during the time of the Maccabees, the Maccabean John Hyrcanus conquered the Edomites in the Edomeans, and he forcefully converted them to Judaism. Converted them at the point of a sword to Judaism. Now, just a note, you as a Gentile believer, as a Christian, will be accused, if you're talking to your Jewish friend, of, well, all you guys have done is converted us at the point of a sword. And that's true. Not for genuine believers, but the Roman Catholic Church did. But and often a Jewish person will say, we don't do that. We don't proselytize people. We don't convert people at the point of a sword. We don't do those kind of things. Well, not totally true, you folks. That's John Hyrcanus did that to the Edomites. And what did that produce? That produced a nominal follower of rabbinic Judaism known as Herod the Great. Herod the Great was an Edomite, an Idumean. He was an Edomite whose family had been forcibly converted to Judaism. And he was never accepted as Jewish by the Jewish people, but he became the king. And one of his descendants was Herod Antipas. Okay, so these two, again, battled against Israel, and most importantly, they battled against the Messiah of Israel when he came. Herod the Great tried to have the Messiah killed when he was first born. And Herod Antipas was no friend of the church and no friend of believers during his reign as well. So there has been a constant fight between the Edomites and the Jewish people ever since the beginning, ever since these two boys struggled in their mother's womb. Okay? Did I see a hand go up for a question that I didn't get to go to? Question. Which order? The map? This one, the map. Am I going to hand out the map to you? I didn't duplicate it. You want the map. Everybody wants the map. Yes. All right. My mistake. All right. I will do my best. I'll tell you what I'll do. I will pull my original out right here, and I will put it in a place where I hopefully will see it, and I will say to Saab, since you're taking care of some responsibility, remind me to run over and get copies of this map made, okay? Okay. So that is the quick, brief history of the Edomites. Descended from Esau, settled in Mount Seir, battled against the Jewish people ever since, right down to Herod the Great. So let me hand out this article on the Edomites. This is a short little dictionary article out of Nelson's New Illustrated Bible Dictionary. Very short article on the Edomites. This will go into a little more detail about what I've shared here. Of course, if you want to get into great detail, there are much more detailed articles available.
So, where am I descended here and where are you?
Where am I descended? You're a Gentile.
Am I over here?
No, you're not an Arab. You're not an Arab. This is the descendants of Ishmael and the descendants of Keturah. Okay, you're not an Arab, right? Okay, so you're not on this. You're not on this chart. I don't know who you're under, but where does your family come from? You were grafted in to the Jewish people through faith. You are grafted in. Okay, that's your identity, but that's your spiritual identity. Your physical identity comes from where? England, Wales, okay? But you're not on that chart. You'd be glad you're not on that chart. Okay. Everybody get a copy? All right, we all set? You got a copy of the article on the Edomites. Okay, that's for later reading, okay? That's for later study. All right, let's move on to page 117. Page 117 on your exegetical outline notes. Let's see. The destruction of Edom. Now, point A, the call to the nations. 1B, I'm turning that into 1C here because we've read the first two phrases. And so this says, let me read the whole verse. The vision of Obadiah, thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and an envoy has been sent among the nations, saying, Arise, let us go against her for battle. So an envoy or an ambassador has been sent out, probably an angelic ambassador, sent out to stir up the nations against Edom, because they hear a report from the Lord. The Lord has sent out this ambassador. So it is probably an angel, because God sovereignly employs nations to accomplish his will. And so he uses angels to stir up nations. Doesn't have to be, but a number of nations are going to be stirred up against Edom. So more than likely, one angelic ambassador is doing this. And he refers to, we have heard a report. That's, of course, Obadiah and the people. There's a supernatural revelation given that's designed, in this case, to bring consolation. It's designed to bring consolation to the Jewish people. Point B in verses 2 through 4, that message is that the pride of Edom will be destroyed. We begin in verse 2 with the population of Edom reduced. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. So the first point of pride that apparently Edom had was that her population was greater than Israel. That a point apparently is her first point of pride. We're bigger than you. But that will be changed. Then point two, she had pride in her security. Not only her population, but her security. Verse 3. The arrogance of your heart has deceived you. You who live in the clefts of the rock, in the loftiness of your dwelling place, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? Now she lives in the clefts of the rock. Now what he's referring to here is the crags of the Mount Seir mountain range. And this is just a small glimpse at one tiny part of the Mount Seir mountain range. I took this picture. No, this picture comes off a postcard I got in Israel down in Eilat. That happens to be Aqaba right there at the very bottom of the screen, which is on the other side of the Gulf of Eilat. But the key point is this is just a typical view of the Mount Seir mountain range. It's 100 miles long and 20 miles wide. And it all looks like that. Here it is. See, we were down here in Eilat looking at the Mount Seir mountain range. And it's a long, very craggy, very inhospitable range of crags there. But there were strongholds. And that's the reference to the clefts of the rock, Selah and Bozra. Tama, Dedan were some of the major cities of Edom that found homes in those rocks. And probably the most well-known city, of course, is Petra or Bozra. And you can see how difficult it would be to... How secure Bozra Petra would be. This is the Sikh. This is the main entrance into Bozra Petra. You can see it is just a cleft, a very narrow canyon going through the Mount Seir mountain range. Look at those cliffs right above you. Here it's narrowed down to just a few donkeys wide, right? There are some areas where it's wider than that, but it's, I believe it's a mile long, twisting defile in the mountain range that leads into the valley in which Petra Basra is located. So if you had just a dozen soldiers at this point, you could hold off a whole army, couldn't you? If they were trying to get in there, you would just you'd pick them off as they tried to come, and you'd just pile up the bodies right there. It'd be very, very hard to get into Basra or Petra through the Sikh, the main entrance. Question?
Were some people feeling revelation to do with the remaining Jews? I mean, trying to get
there? That is our position, or my position here. I believe that the main body of those that flee Judea will be there in Basra Petra, yes. Yeah, it's east and west, they're sheer cliffs. In fact, let's take another look at here's another view of Basra Petra. I forget which building this is. I forgot to write down what it is, but you see how this building is literally just carved out of the cliffs of the Mount Seir mountain range. Question.
For the features, it looks like there is practically vegetation. Where does the water come from?
There are springs there. There is water sources in there, and there are in that valley there are level areas where crops are grown or have been grown in the past. Yeah, it looks so barren, but there is water. In fact, when the Romans took over there, they had some very interesting water courses built, and there were even fountains there. So there is water available, and you can grow crops there. Although a lot of the habitations, many of the habitations are in these cliffs. You see these caves? People live in the caves. They literally chopped this facade out of the rock there. It's amazing. I haven't had the privilege of visiting there, so I can only show you secondhand pictures. But it's quite an amazing place. East and west of Basra Petra, it's sheer cliffs, east and west. The Sikh comes in, I should say, from the in a westerly direction. And to the north and south, it's just this convoluted mountain range on either side. So it's very, very hard to get in from north and south, although you can. And then east and west, it's just sheer cliffs. No, this is a picture off of a... this is a picture I just scanned in off of one of those things you can buy in the Holy Land where you get about a dozen pictures on an accordion thing. I just bought that because I've never been there. Okay, so when we go next time, I'm going to talk Dennis into going there. Okay, I would love to go there and see that place. Apparently, it's very touristy now. Question? Oh, that's been inhabited since Esau moved there. These cities are thousands of years old. These locations, yeah, they've been there a long time. Now, basically, Basra Petra is only inhabited by tourists these days. You know that basically, but it was a thriving trade center. Became very, very well used because it commanded the trade routes. It was right on the trade routes. When the trade routes shifted, Basra Petra faded into obscurity. There was no reason to be there. Well, traders would come in there, camel caravans would come in there. It was a very important city at one time. Yeah, it sure was. This is in Edom. This is in the Mount Seir mountain range. In fact, yeah, that's why buildings like this somebody could afford to chop it out. And this is one of dozens of buildings in Petra. And that means they had plenty of money to be able to employ people to carve out stuff like that. It took years to do that, and that's just typical of, like I said, dozens of buildings there. Slave labor, yeah, could have been, but they also had artisans. Yeah, slave labor was a little different than, in many cases, when we think of slave labor in the Deep South. Many times a slave was more of an artisan than just a body that you employed to do manual labor. Mount Seir and the Edomites and their cities were very, very secure, as you can see, living in this Mount Seir mountain range in the clefts of the rock. He says in verse 3, the loftiness of your dwelling place, either habitation was up on high in the mountain range. They were proud of their defenses, and they felt very secure. And they had reason to. But what does God say about this in verse 4? Verse 4, though you build high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. So this is the answer to the boast of verse 3. Who will bring me down? Edom said in verse 3. And God said, I'm going to bring you down. Maybe the nations around you can't, but I can use them to bring you down. And isn't that quite a picture there? Building high like an eagle. An eagle, of course, builds its nest high in a tree, almost inaccessible. Building your nest among the stars, looking up at Mount Seir at night, and you would see the stars up there. Look up at that mountain range. Nice picture there. Though you're there, I will bring you down. The totality of the destruction is brought out in verses 5 through 9. And the totality of the destruction is depicted in two word pictures, two cases of plundering. Or actually, I should say one case of plundering and one case of harvesting. And in these cases, one of plundering and one of harvesting, there's still something left when the harvester or the plunderer gets done. But the enemies of Edom will do much worse than that. Normally there's something left, but in Edom there won't be anything left. Verse 5. And there's a contrast between the complete and the incomplete plundering. First of all, verse 5. If thieves come to you, if robbers by night, oh how you will be ruined. But would they not steal only enough? Would they not steal only until they had enough? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave some gleanings? Okay, as you see point 1 and 2, thieves wouldn't take it all. Harvesters wouldn't take it all. There'd be something left. But in contrast, Edom is going to be totally cleaned out. Edom is going to be thoroughly ransacked. Verse 6. Oh, how Esau is ransacked and his hidden treasures searched out. And so you see point 1 and 2 there. It's going to be total. Nothing is going to be hidden that will escape. And his reference there to Edom's wealth is a reference to the prosperity of the nation because they controlled prosperous trade routes. And of course, Bozrah Petra was one of those key cities that was very rich. And so there's a complete destruction, point 1. A contrast, page 118. One of the sources of the complete destruction will be deceptive alliances in verse 7. See, Edom's security rested in her physical position, high in Mount Seir, but her security also rested in these alliances, her political position. And the problem is that Edom will not have the wisdom to see the signs of betrayal. She's not going to see it. She's going to be so caught up in her pride, she's going to be blindsided. Pride does that to you. Verse 7. All the men allied with you will send you forth to the border, and the men at peace with you will deceive you and overpower you. They who eat your bread will set an ambush for you. There is no understanding in him. So point A there. The ones confederate with Edom will be the ones to destroy here. You see what a direct assault could not do. You see, a direct assault could not do it. You see the sick there. What a direct assault could not do, treachery will. There's more than one way to skin a cat, right? There's more than one way to bring Edom down. And did you note the emphasis on hospitality there? They who eat bread with you will set an ambush for you. That points out the importance of hospitality in the ancient Near Eastern mind. Eating with someone meant secure friendship and fellowship. To eat with somebody meant that I am your partner. To invite somebody to eat with you, you are one with me. You are my friend. I will care for you. It's not a casual thing. Today in 21st century America, you know, we have the quick business lunch. We go out, we have lunch, we do a business deal, and then we go on. And a lunch means nothing. It's just an opportunity to sign a contract or something like that. See, for us, eating together doesn't have near the importance that it did in the ancient Near Eastern mind. And so you see here, they who eat your bread are going to set an ambush against you. This is a terrible treachery. A terrible treachery in the ancient Near Eastern mind. Now, let's take that and let's take it over to Yeshua, right? What did Yeshua say? The one who ate with me will lift up his heel against me, right? Yeshua was betrayed by one whom he invited to eat with him. Who? Judas Iscariot. One of his band of disciples. Not only ate with him, but lived with him. And of course, it was at the Passover. He's eating with him. And that's where that betrayal says, go do what you plan on doing. This was a terrible treachery on Judas's part. Especially in the ancient Near Eastern mind. Okay. Point B there. It says, brought to the border. If you were allied with somebody, you escorted the envoys to the border as a mark of loyalty. But this is all a ploy. The Edomites would make arrangements with these other nations. The other nations would say, sure, we're with you. They'd escort them to the border. Ah, it's guaranteed. So if the alliance was not agreed upon, if you went somewhere and you could not agree upon an alliance, the ambassador would return to his country without escort. But here, we've signed an agreement. We're buddies. I'm going to escort you to the border. Another example of the terrible treachery. Question? No question. Okay, don't raise your hand. I'll either sell you something or call on you. Sold. Okay. So Edom is in for it. She's going to be blindsided. Verse 8. Not only blindsided by these alliances, but here's the reason why. There'll be a collapse of wisdom in verse 8. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy wise men from Edom and understanding from the mountain of Esau? So the wise men are about to be brought down. In other words, the king's cabinet is about to be confounded. His secretary of defense is going to be confused. He's going to come with a report that we've got all our defenses in order. But nobody is seeing the signs of treachery. And finally, in verse 9, there'll be a collapse of courage. Verse 9. Then your mighty men will be dismayed, O Teman, in order that everyone may be cut off from the mountain of Esau by slaughter. So along with this collapse of wisdom, there's going to be a collapse of bravery and daring and valor. These mighty men will be mighty no longer. He mentions in point A the strength of Teman. Teman is either a district or a city in Edom. We're not totally sure which. It's either a district, like a county, something like that, or a key city. But it speaks of the totality of the slaughter, because the most courageous warriors are terrified here. Most courageous warriors are terrified. Now at this point, I want to hand out an application chart to you. This is something we'll see as we continue on through the next few verses. And we're going to deal with this idea of pride and what it can do to you. So I'll hand out this chart dealing with the first nine verses.
We need a chart for this, if we don't know.
It's a good reminder. Good reminder. No, we probably don't need a chart, do we? But it's so easy to fall into pride that we ought to have one. Okay, everybody get a chart? The application chart? Okay, we've just looked at Obadiah, verses 1 through 9, and we saw that the theme is the destruction of Edom due to overwhelming pride. And you see the biblical application. There's pride in her fortifications, pride in her wealth, pride in her connections, pride in her wisdom, pride in her military strength, her soldiers. And we need to ask ourselves, instead of pointing the finger at Edom, we need to point the finger at ourselves. Do we exhibit pride in the same areas of our lives? What pride might we be struggling with? with our security? You know, are we? Do we think our job will last forever? Do we think our retirement is, we've got it made? So our security can be a lot of different things. How about our wealth? Our money, our possessions, our credit, our investments, hey, we've got it made. We've got our budget all together. How about our connections? They might be career connections, or they might be religious connections, or they might be social connections. But we might be proud in that. I've got it made. I've got it made. Our education, how about our degrees or our titles? Now that I've got my doctorate, my 5 doctorates, my 10 doctorates, I got it made. Man, you know, is there anything wrong with education? Nope. But you sure can, you can get proud in having PhD after your name, right? Joining the Food family. The Food family, PhD. That's a joke, you guys, okay? Nothing wrong with being a member of that family. Just don't take pride in it. How about your power? Could it be at work? Could you be a supervisor and you have power over these people? Or could you be a CEO? Or how about in your family? Or in your church? Are you in a powerful position in one of these two areas? And you're proud of it? It can all get us, you guys. It can all sneak up on us, can't it? These are just so common. So common. What could you do to cooperate with God and root out pride in your life so that you won't suffer loss? God hates pride. He'll bring it down. No matter how strong your source of pride seems to be. Any comments, any thoughts on pride?
Just about the time you lick one.
About the time you lick one, you're battling another. Good insight. Boy, good insight, yeah. Just enough. Hey, that's a good prayer. Yeah. Yeah, Lord, encourage that teacher, but not too much. Yeah, keep it balanced, yeah. Oh, yes. In the Proverbs. Give me enough money that I won't be in want and therefore steal and defame your name, but don't give me so much that I forget about you. Just give me my daily needs. Yeah, in the Proverbs, money. Well, yeah, you look at Solomon and he lost his wisdom, huh, didn't he? He was the wisest man and yet he was not able to see the seeds of destruction that were coming to his household, did he? So I think pride could have very easily blinded him. Question or comment?
I think, too, that you know, this shows us that we don't, you know, when we start putting our trust in other things, nothing is secure in this world.
That's right. Yeah, and a lot of people learned this the hard way with the high-tech crash just last year, didn't they? All the dot-coms that went out of business and all, you know, people were, they thought they had it made. The Enron, yeah, they had made millions of dollars in the stock market, and all of a sudden it was gone. Boy, that'll take the pride out of your sales.
We also look at this in relationship to our country.
Sure. Yeah, we can get very proud over... being we're the most powerful country in the world. We have the most, the best military. You know, we got to be careful. We all have to. Did I see a hand over here?
One time, I had a lot of property and money.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very prideful about that, and I ended up destitute.
Wow! Yeah.
because I need to lock in a pension.
And
that,
yeah, got to have security. Yeah.
And the Lord said to me, haven't you learned that I am your only security?
Right, right.
And so I went on
the mission. Okay, great.
And the Lord has never left me nor forsaken me.
Right.
So
yep.
He is my security.
Yeah.
Nothing else. No doctorates, nothing.
Right. That's it. We focus on the Lord, takes care of the pride. That's for sure. Good application. Okay, I've kept you 5 minutes over, but I'm still going to give you a 15-minute break. So at 10 till, you'll hear the shofar. Come on back, and we'll continue in Obadiah. There's a lot of stuff here in the second half, so we may not get through it. We'll just have to see. Okay. Now, we've seen God decree a total destruction of Edom. Now, why in the world would he do that? And now on page 119 of your notes, we come to the reason for the destruction of Edom. We saw that one source of that destruction was pride, but here's the key. The key is in verse 10, violence against your brother Jacob. And verse 10 is really a summary statement of the major problem. Verse 10. Because of violence to your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame and you will be cut off forever. So, of course, we saw on our chart that Edom was the brother of the Jewish people. Point 2. It's for violence of brother against brother. Point 2. And that word violence in Hebrew is, guess what? Hamas. Hamas. That's what the word in Hebrew means. Hamas means violence. Now, of course, when it's used by the Muslim terrorists, it's an Arabic acronym that means Islamic Resistance Movement, or ZEAL. The word in Arabic means zeal, and it stands for Islamic Resistance Movement. But the word Hamas in Hebrew is violence, and that's kind of ironic, isn't it? Is this God's sense of humor? It's for violence against a brother against brother, and we'll see this is going down even to today. So Hamas is moral wrong and overt physical brutality. That's what violence, Hamas, is. Moral wrong and overt physical brutality. It's quite an amazing word. So one of the reasons for the destruction is violence of brother against brother. You know, in contrast, Israel was committed, or I should say commanded in the law, to preserve a friendly and brotherly attitude toward Edom. In the law of Moses, Israel is commanded to have a friendly and brotherly attitude toward Edom. Deuteronomy 2, verses 4 and 5. Deuteronomy 23, verse 7. Deuteronomy 2, 4 and 5. Deuteronomy 23, verse 7. So the one who is doing the violence is Edom. Not that the two didn't struggle with each other, but we'll get a look at this violence by Edom in just a little bit. The results, of course, Edom will be shamed, no more pride, and totally cut off. Now the details follow. Verse 11. Verse 11 details their hostile attitude. Here's the details of their violence. Verse 11. On the day you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, you too were as one of them. So point one, Edom stood back. She didn't help. She was aloof. She didn't want to get involved. And of course, point A, the foreigners despoiled Jerusalem and cast lots over Jerusalem. And point two, the result of this attitude, she was just as responsible. Just as responsible for the destruction as those who actively participated in it. Edom did not attempt to help her brother. So she's just as guilty of the crime. So today, when we see Israel say things like, we're going to go after ticking bombs, but that is not limited to those wearing the belts. It also includes those who encourage and supply and take and make sure that these bombers do their work. It's the same idea. Those who encourage terrorism are just as guilty of the crime, and that's the principle here.
Saul
and Stephen stoning. Yeah, he stood back. He didn't watch. He didn't throw a stone, but he was just as guilty. Why was he persecuting Jesus himself? And so that's a very important principle we need to keep in mind. Okay, so there was a hostile attitude. Then there was a glee over the fall, enjoyment. Verse 12, they actually enjoyed watching. Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. So this aloof attitude was not based on ignorance. I didn't know what was happening. It was not based on fear. I was afraid to get involved. Edom stood back and laughed. Edom knew very well what was going on. And she was not afraid, as you'll see in just a moment. So look not in the day of disaster. That's the gloating. That's the malicious pleasure she took. Point two, rejoice not. So she's rejoicing over misfortune. In other words, saying it's about time they got it. It's about time, you know, feeling good about it. And then speak not proudly. That's boasting. They had it coming. They had it coming. Wow, look at that. It's about time they had it coming. Okay, question. Oh yeah, things haven't changed. Things haven't changed. Racing and the boasting, perhaps, but the world did not get involved for many reasons in the Holocaust. Yeah. Okay, so there's a hostile attitude of Edom that results in glee. But then point D, that was the first two points. Points B and C are distant involvement, but point D is active involvement in verse 13. Point D. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Yes, you do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster, and do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster. So it appears from verse 13 that as soon as the fighting was over, as soon as the gory stuff, the actual fighting was over, as soon as the damage was done, as soon as they could get involved, they looted the city too. Now, I'm sure the Arabs and the Philistines, who had done the damage, were not very eager to have the Edomites come in until they were done looting. You know, we do all the work, and you don't dare come in here till we're done. But as soon as they got done, I'm sure, Edom came in and took what was left. And so three comments are made. Do not enter the gates. Do not look on their affliction. Do not lay hand on their substance. That's what Edom did. Yes, it's basically Jerusalem here is getting sacked and destroyed.
The whole Edom is against Jerusalem in this case?
Yes, the Edomites are now coming into Jerusalem, have the opportunity to come into the defeated city and take what's left. This is the destruction of Jerusalem. This is the destruction probably of Jerusalem in, let me go back to the beginning here. Not 586, that would be. Yeah. This is the, let me back up just a little bit to our introductory stuff. This is probably the destruction of Jerusalem in 845, under Jehoram, 845. And back way back on page 115 or so, with the exegetical notes in the introduction, you have cross references on page 115 on 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, and you also have on page 116. Whoops, I went too far, missed it. You also have some more cross references there on page 116. No problem. Yeah, page 116, you have 2 Chronicles 21. Okay, so back on 115 to 116. That'll set it. Okay, the good guys are the Jewish people, especially those living in Jerusalem. The bad guys are the Arabs, the Philistines, and here we're focusing on the Edomites. So the Edomites are getting involved as soon as they're permitted. Question? Jehoram. It's on your notes there. Jehoram. Yeah. Page, it'll mention the king. That's King Jehoram. Okay? Alrighty. So they had a hostile attitude. They rejoiced over the fall. They spoiled the city. Verse 14, they went even further. They couldn't just leave it at that. Verse 14, first part of the verse. Do not stand in the fork of the road and cut off their fugitives. So their enmity went even further. They blocked the escape of those fleeing the battle. And then in the second part of verse 14, and do not imprison the survivors in the day of their distress. So apparently they blocked the escape of the fugitives, the survivors, and then they turned them over to the enemy. They turned them over to the Philistines and the Arabs. And that is probably where they earned the right to loot. That's probably where they earned the right. Oh, you know, can we go in now? Sure. You helped us. You go in and you get the gleanings. That's probably why the Arabs and the Philistines allowed them in. So that's pretty sick, isn't it? Yeah, fugitives are fleeing warfare. They've just been decimated, lost everything, and they're trying to flee someplace safe. They flee to their brother country, Edom, and what happens? They get just turned back in. And now this is in Ezekiel here, and you see point G on your outline, in Ezekiel 35, 1 through 5, Ezekiel is referring to the Babylonian destruction. It's a little different. Obadiah is referring to the time when the Philistines and Arabs sacked Jerusalem. But the point of Ezekiel 35 is that enmity had never ceased. Edom never had enough blood. So this is what happened in 845. Now, 100 or so years later, here's what Ezekiel says about Edom in Ezekiel 35, 1 through 5. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, set your face against Mount Seir and prophesy against it, and say to it, Thus says the Lord God, Behold, I am against you, Mount Seir. Of course, that's Edom, where they live now, Mount Seir, mountain range. I will stretch out my hand against you, and I will make you like a desolation and a waste. I will lay waste to your cities. You will become a desolation. Then you will know that I am the Lord, because you have had everlasting enmity, and have delivered the sons of Israel to the power of the sword at the time of their calamity, at the time of the punishment of the end. So this is the point. This enmity that started in the womb goes on and on and on. Let me read to you a little section from the Sanchino books of the Bible. I thought this was a good little paragraph that points out this everlasting enmity. From as far back, from that far back day, when their ancestors wrestled in the womb of Rebekah, to the very eve of the Christian era, when the Jewish king John Hyrcanus dragged the Idumeans beneath the yoke of the law, the two people scorned, hated, and scourged each other with a relentlessness that finds no analogy between kindred and neighbor nations anywhere else in history. About 1030, David. About 130, the Hasmoneans were equally at war with Edom. And few are the prophets between those distant dates who did not cry for vengeance against him or exult over his overthrow. And it's going on today. The descendants of Edom are still relentlessly attacking their brother. Okay, now in verses 15 and 16, we jump forward into the tribulation period. We'll see that things are not going to change. We jump to the day of Jehovah, the tribulation period. Now, if indeed Obadiah is the first prophet to write down his revelation that he saw, he begins a theme here called the Day of the Lord that's picked up by the other prophets. So this may be very well the very beginning of this theme, the Day of the Lord. What is the Day of the Lord like? First, verse 15, it's a day of retribution. For the Day of the Lord draws near on all the nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head. Now Obadiah's outlook is worldwide. It's no longer Edom. It's all nations. So the destruction of verses 1 through 9 in your notes says will be fulfilled in the Great Tribulation. I really think the point there is that what we see way back in Obadiah's day is going to be the same situation in the tribulation period. That's the link there. As he looks along the timeline, he sees that nothing has changed. So verses 1 through 9 deal with the destruction. Verses 9 through 14 deal with why the destruction of Edom. And now in verses 15 and 16, when this total destruction of Edom is actually going to occur. And the point, what they did to Israel will be done to them. That's the principle of you sow what you reap. Or it's the principle of the Abrahamic covenant. Those who curse you, I will curse. Here it's upon all nations, but most explicitly upon Edom. So this is the day of the Lord. The cause of the retribution is in verse 16. Because just as you drank on my holy mountain, all the nations will drink continually. They will drink and swallow and become as if they never existed. This is seen as messianic by the majority of Jewish commentators. They see this retribution as when the Messiah comes. So the first point is they celebrated on Mount Zion. They were celebrating, probably in the temple courts, celebrating Israel's defeat, despoiling and destruction. But just as they swallowed wine, now they will be swallowed up. Just as they swallowed wine, now they will be swallowed up. And the reference there, Zechariah 12, 2 and 3, Zechariah picks up this theme of drunkenness. And he, when we get to Zechariah, we'll see this as well. This is the tribulation as well. Behold, I'm going to make Jerusalem a cup that causes reeling to all the peoples around. And when the siege is against Jerusalem, it will also be against Judah. And it will come about in that day that I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will be severely injured, and all the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. So Jerusalem is going to be another cup that causes reeling. Jerusalem here is pictured as a huge bowl of wine. That's the picture in Zechariah. The nations are gathering around, thinking they're going to have a victory celebration. They're going to drink out of this huge bowl of wine and celebrate. But instead, they get out of control. They get drunk. And they find themselves staggering to destruction. And what has happened to Jerusalem in the past will be duplicated in the future. But now we jump into one more step into the future. We jump out of the tribulation period. And now as we get to verses 17 through 21, we jump into the Messianic Kingdom. We transition into the Messianic Kingdom. And we come to the restoration for Israel. There'll be no restoration for Edom, is what he says in verse 16. But there will be a restoration for Israel. The Arabs and the Edomites, but she will be restored. Jerusalem may suffer in the tribulation, but she will be restored. Question.
The destruction of Edom, you said that it would be complete during the tribulation. But at this time, there really isn't a nation called Edom.
No, there is no... No, there is no nation formally called Edom today, no.
So those Edomites have essentially blended into the total Arabic
community. They're blended into the Arabic community, yes. Yes, right. Verse 18, we'll talk more about the destruction of Edom in just a moment. Okay, verse 17, God talks about the remnant that will escape. But, there's your contrasting word, but on Mount Zion there will be those who escape, and it will be holy. And the house of Jacob will possess their possessions. They will escape. This is a very, very important theme that comes out in the prophets. And you see the cross references there. I'm going to bring them out. Isaiah 4:2. In that day, when the kingdom begins, in that day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. There will be survivors. Isaiah 10:20-23. Now it will come about in that day that the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but they will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant within them will return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness. A complete destruction, one that is decreed. The Lord God of hosts will execute it in the midst of the whole land. So even though there will be destruction come upon Israel, there will be a restoration. Isaiah 37. And the surviving remnant, there it is again, the surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem will go forth a remnant, and out of Mount Zion survivors. The zeal of the Lord of hosts shall perform this. Joel talked about it in 2:32. It will come about that whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be delivered. For on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there will be those who escape, as the Lord has said, even among the survivors whom the Lord calls. And I also want to bring in Zechariah 13. Verses 8 and 9 again, a very important theme. Israel will survive the tribulation, even though two-thirds of us will be killed. Here it is. And it will come about in all the land, declares the Lord, that two parts in it will be cut off and perish, and the third will be left in it. And I will bring the third part through the fire, refine them as silver is refined, and test them as gold is tested. They will call on my name, and I will answer them. I will say, they are my people. And they will say, the Lord is my God. So, that's quite a pattern that we see. A very, very serious and sober pattern laid out for the Jewish people. But a pattern that ends with glory. Point two says, they will repossess their possessions. I think... It would be better to render that... Excuse me, point two. They will be holy. Okay? Point two. They will be holy. I think a better rendering of that would be it will be holy. It's a reference to Mount Zion. It will be holy. There's a better rendering. So I would just... Point two. They will be holy. I think it would be better rendered, it will be holy. And I think it's a reference to Mount Zion. And a holy mountain, Mount Zion, demands holy inhabitants. A holy mountain demands holy inhabitants, and that's the whole point of Romans 11:25-27. Israel will be holy at that time, a saved nation. I do not want you, brethren, to be uninformed of this mystery. This was something that was not revealed, lest you should be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. That's the mystery. That's the church. That's God reaching out around the world to the Gentiles worldwide. But once that happens, once the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, and thus all Israel will be saved, just as it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion, he will remove ungodliness from Jacob, and this is my covenant with them, when I take away their sins. So the one-third is left, the one-third that is left, the remnant that is left, will be holy. They will all be regenerate. That's what it means when all Israel will be saved. Every living Jewish man, woman, and child at the end of the tribulation will place their faith in Yeshua. And then, point three, they will repossess their possessions. Then we will experience the second regathering. You see, the first regathering that we're experiencing now will lead to the tribulation. The first regathering is a regathering in unbelief, in preparation for judgment, the judgment of the great tribulation. That is what we see today. We just read about it when we did Josh News, right? 90% of the Israelis are atheist and agnostic. 90% of the Jewish community is atheist agnostic today. But with the second regathering is different. It will be in faith, in preparation for blessing, the blessing of the Messianic Kingdom. And that's what Isaiah is talking about in Isaiah 11:11. Then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand, what? The remnant of his people, okay? Who will remain from Assyria. So this is worldwide. This is a worldwide scattering. Who will remain from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamat, and from the islands of the sea. And he will lift up a standard for the nations. This is the nations of the world. And will assemble the banished ones of Israel. And will gather the dispersed of Judah from where? From the four corners of the earth. And so there is a great time of distress coming upon Israel. But Israel will survive and Israel will be restored. But not Edom. Verse 18. Not Edom. And now we look at what's going to happen to Edom in the Messianic Kingdom. Verse 18. Am I going too fast? Verse 18, we're on the bottom of page... we're in bottom of page 121. Okay? Then the house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau will be as stubble. And they will set them on fire and consume them, so that there will be no survivor in the house of Esau. So it's a dramatic word picture of a fierce fire utterly consuming a pile of straw. Utterly consuming a pile of straw. So Edom will be destroyed by Israel. And notice it says Jacob and Joseph in verse 18. That's the southern kingdom. Jacob, the northern kingdom, under the term Joseph. In other words, a reunited nation will destroy Edom, the Edomites. And there will be no remnant left. And that's repeated in Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel there at the bottom of the page. No, not all the Arab nations. We can't conclude that from the cross references A, B, and C there. If you read those, you will see. Here's the results that those cross references... I'm going to summarize the results of those cross references. Edom will become a burning wasteland of pitch and brimstone during the Messianic Kingdom. This is what these verses bring out. Edom will become a burning wasteland of pitch and brimstone during the Messianic Kingdom. The rest of the world will be blossoming. The rest of the world will be like the Garden of Eden. But there will be two burning wastelands in the kingdom. One will be Edom, and one will be Babylon. Isaiah 13 is the reference to Babylon. Isaiah 13. But let's, of those cross-references, there's an Isaiah 34 reference at the top, right? All right, let's take a look at this Isaiah 34 reference. Why do I say all this? Isaiah 34, let's take a look at it. In Isaiah 34, verses 1 through 4, the whole world is in view, okay? That's the context. But then in verses 5 through 15, the focus comes on Edom. Let's do verses 5 through 9. For my sword is satiated in heaven. Behold, it shall descend for judgment upon Edom and upon the people whom I have devoted to destruction. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is sated with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. Wild oxen shall also fall with them, and young bulls with strong ones. Thus their land shall be soaked with blood, and their dust become greasy with fat. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. Speaking of Edom, its streams shall be turned into pitch, its loose earth into brimstone, and its land shall become burning pitch. So this is the result. Edom will be a wasteland of pitch and brimstone. Brimstone is burning, sulfur. Sulfur. We had a weapon in the army. What was it? Sulfur grenade. It burns as soon as the... Phosphorus. Yeah, okay, difference. Okay, white phosphorus. Yeah, wrong stuff. But it'll be something like that. So there's going to... In verse 10... It shall not be quenched night or day. Its smoke shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall be desolate. None shall pass through it forever and ever. So we're going to have a continual, impassable wasteland during the millennial kingdom in the region of Edom. Now let's continue on with verses 11 through 15. Verses 11 through 15 talks about the inhabitants of this burning, impassable wasteland. A burning sulfur. But pelican and hedgehog shall possess it, and owl and raven shall dwell in it, and he shall stretch over it the line of desolation and the plumb line of emptiness. Its nobles, there's no one there whom they may proclaim king, and its princes shall be nothing. And thorns shall come up from its fortified towers, nettles and thistles in its fortified cities. It shall also be the haunt of jackals and the abode of ostriches. And the desert creatures shall meet with the wolves. The hairy goat also shall cry to its kind. Yes, the night monster shall settle there and shall find herself a resting place. The tree snake shall make its nest and lay eggs there, and it will hatch and gather them under its protection. Yes, the hawks will be gathered there, every one with its kind. All right. This verse speaks of animals inhabiting the area. What are these animals? Who's way ahead of me there? The Hebrew words for these animals are not known. We don't know what these Hebrew words mean. These animal words that are given in the English are mostly guesswork. They are mostly guesswork. If you compare translations, you'll see them vary. We don't really know what these words mean. Translators do guesswork, folks. But we have to ask ourselves a question. Can animals like this live in a burning wasteland of sulfur and pitch? Can animals live in this kind of environment? Can ostriches and hedgehogs and pelicans live in that kind of stuff? Well, can these be literal animals? The clue is in verse 14. The clue comes under that word here, hairy goat. Okay? The word translated hairy goat there, we do know what it means. It refers to a demon in goat form. This is not a normal word for wild goat. Lots of angels and demons apparently have animal-like characteristics. So this word hairy goat means a demon in goat form. Also, night monster. The night monster shall settle there. That means in Hebrew, the night demon. The night demon will settle there. It's no accident that the symbol of the Church of Satan is a goat, folks. So this is a reference, apparently, to demons of the night and demons in goat form. So that's what I think is the best guess regarding these words. It's best to consider them references to demons, because demons can live in an environment like this, while literal animals cannot. Literal animals cannot. And so during the Messianic Kingdom, there will be two burning wastelands that will be the prison house of the demons. That's where they'll be confined. Babylon and Edom, southern Jordan, the territory of southern Jordan. Well, I see I'm running out of time here. We've got to get through three verses, and there's a lot to cover in three verses. So let's plow ahead. Verse 19 on the bottom of the page there. Israel's possession of the Gentile nations, verse 19. Then those of the Negev will possess the mountain of Esau, and those of the Shephelah, the Philistine plain, also possess the territory of Ephraim and the territory of Samaria, and Benjamin will possess Gilead. Now you see on your notes, point C, that Dr. Fruchtenbaum has put a little interpretive parenthesis there. They have the Negev, Simeon, they have the Shephelah, Judah, and then the 10 tribes will possess Samaria and Ephraim. That's a little interpretive. I'm not totally comfortable with that, because the word is just a pronoun there, those or they. I think New King James has done the best job of translating Obadiah 19. The south shall possess the mountains of Esau. The lowland shall possess Philistia. They shall possess the fields of Ephraim and the fields of Samaria. Benjamin shall possess Gilead. This is a reference to the entire nation. So the Jewish people will possess Mount Seir, the Jewish people will possess the Philistine plain, and the Jewish people will possess Samaria and Ephraim. The only tribe actually mentioned is Benjamin. Now, little Benjamin was on the west side of the Jordan, but in the kingdom, it's going to possess land on the east side as well. It's going to possess Gilead, or a portion of Gilead. I don't know quite how much of Gilead. Now, this is a map of Israel in the Messianic Kingdom. And in the Messianic Kingdom, the tribes will be given their possessions from north to south. It says in the book of Ezekiel, Dan, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Ephraim, Reuben, Judah. Somewhere between Judah and Benjamin will find the holy city of Jerusalem. Now here's Benjamin. And it says, Benjamin shall possess Gilead. Well, Gilead is this whole area on this side of the Jordan, on the east side of the Jordan, from about the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea. Now, I don't know what to do with that, because Benjamin was a little slot of land right in here. Does that mean that Benjamin will just cross over and possess a little bit of Gilead? Or does that mean the holdings of Benjamin take up this much area? If it does, that means I got to move Jerusalem up here, north of the Sea of Galilee, and I got to move Judah up higher. So I don't quite know what to do with that. I can tell you at least this much, that Benjamin's territory will at least cross over the Jordan River and possess part of Gilead. Exactly how much, I don't know. So that's part of my ongoing struggle with the boundaries of the land in the kingdom. And we're running out of time, so I'll pass out these two charts as soon as we get done, okay? The maps of the Israel and the Messianic Kingdom. Let's move on to page 122 and verse 20. So I'll just keep you a little bit over today, but we will get through Obadiah. Verse 20 talks about the return of the captives. And the exiles of this host of the sons of Israel, who are among the Canaanites as far as Zarephath, and the exiles of Jerusalem, who are in Sepharad, will possess the cities of the Negev. The point? That Jews from all over the world will possess the promised land. And here's where Dr. Fruchtenbaum has a concern. You can see on point C there, it's possible, he says, that the events of verses 10 through 14 could be in the Great Tribulation. If that's true, then we have this alternate on the bottom of your chart, verses 1 through 9 in Obadiah's present, 10 through 16 being in the Tribulation. So we're not quite sure. And if that means, if that happens, that means that Israel is captive to the Antichrist rather than Philistia, the Arabs, or Edom. So it's possible that could be about the Antichrist. But basically, they're possessing all, the Jewish people will possess all the promised land. That's the point there. Second part of the verse, verse 20b there, the captivity of Jerusalem will end. And you see point A, it talks about Sepharad. That's, we don't know where Sepharad, excuse me, where Sepharad is. It could be a reference to Spain. That's where we get the term Sephardic Jewry. So this could be, yes, okay. That could be a reference to Jewish people scattered into Spain, coming back, possessing the Negev. So the Sephardic community may have a large community in the Negev. We don't know. Okay. They will. Okay. It's possible. And finally, the establishment of the kingdom comes in verse 21. The deliverers will ascend to Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. So saviors will come to Mount Zion. Now the messianic commentators Radok and Metzudat David, and in the commentary Devarim Rabbah, those rabbis all see this as a messianic verse, and they say that the saviors who come to Mount Zion will be the Messiah and his officers. They feel this is a reference to the Messiah and those who come with him. So that could be a reference to us, because we come back with the Messiah. It could be a reference to just officers, perhaps the 12 apostles, who knows. But saviors will come to Mount Zion, probably a reference to the return of Yeshua and those of us returning with him. And then the messianic kingdom is instituted in that the kingdom is the Lord's. Now I'm going to end our time together by giving you four handouts, okay? We don't have time to go over these, but most of them you don't have to. First of all, it'll be this map of Israel and the messianic kingdom, followed by number two, the tribes in the messianic kingdom. Okay, then I was going to give us an application dealing with Obadiah and again prideful actions and their consequences. So I want you to read that over as far as application goes. But because pride is such a problem for all of us, I did a little study. I copied off a study from the NASB Topical Index. So if you want to study pride and the dangers of pride, there's an outline for you to go over. So let me hand out these four handouts, and I'll let you go.